This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel, and with 2015 just around the corner, we're taking a moment to look back at some of the highlights of the show this past year. And we continue our look back series today with another member of the State of Things staff who usually sits on the other side of the glass. Producer Anita Rao joins me in the studio. Hello, Anita.
Hey, Frank.
How's it look this side, this little space?
Not what I expected.
What you expected. Well, listen, tell us about the first conversation that you have for us today.
Yeah, so I want to spend this first segment talking about the Monday Meet series. Something we do every Monday, we spend an hour with a guest talking about their life and their work and how those two things intersect. And this is one of my favorite kind of segments to produce. I love the opportunity to spend hours on the phone with people and really get to know some of their deep and personal stories. So the first clip we're going to hear today is from an interview we did just last month with a woman named Missy Cummings. She is one of the nation's leading drone experts. She works at Duke now. She runs a humans and autonomy lab. But she came to this work from a pretty interesting background. She was one of the first female fighter pilots for the U.S. Navy. And she sat down and she told us some of her stories from what it was like to be a fighter pilot in the mid-90s.
My very first day of training in baby jets, someone died. And, you know, about once a month for the next few years of my life, I would know someone who would die in a plane crash. My first time at the aircraft carrier, when you learn how to land, put a jet on an aircraft carrier, it was the worst training accident ever on the USS Lexington. And so it was a hard lesson to learn, except that, you know, again, you've got all this training in you, and your instructors tell you people are going to die. This is war. This is what we're training for. And so it's bad, but you also learn to accept it.
Learn to accept it, but again, I guess in your Quixote kind of way, you decided also to question and challenge it to some extent and felt that these didn't really have to happen.
Right. Well, when I decided to leave the military and go into the academic world, my motivation was looking around at the cockpits and seeing the accidents. By far, most of the accidents were avoidable. And this is true in aviation in general. 80% of accidents are human error. And this is more than true in military aviation. There were so many deaths always attributed to human pilot error. And, you know, nobody was really asking better questions about, well, how could we stop this from happening then?
And so that was what you were going to explore. I need to get some of the stories, though, that you tell while you were a pilot are pretty incredible, including your call sign.
Yes, people don't get that most call signs are actually to make fun of you because, you know, if you were choosing your own call sign, I would have been like Viper or Eagle. But in fact, you get call signs mostly because of stupid things you do. And my very first call sign is, you'll have to remember this was at the 80s, and I decided to get a perm. And so I got this perm that was just out of control, and I walked into the ready room one day, and somebody goes, hey, Medusa, nice hair. And that stuck with me for a long time.
But then you got another one.
Yeah, my last one was Shrew. And I'm a huge Shakespeare buff, and so I think the guys thought that they were trying to really get under my skin. But in the end, I loved it. And then I started using it on myself, and that kind of rubbed them the wrong way.
You said that actually, I mean, things were rough at Annapolis, but even worse in that culture of fighter pilots.
Yes. Well, and so I was one of the first women to transition into true fighters. So I was, as an adversary pilot, you know, we were flying fighter planes, but we weren't considered fighter pilots. And then when the combat exclusion law was repealed in 1993, I was in that first group of women to make the transition into real fighter pilot world. And yeah, I mean, this was the last bastion of the warrior club, and they did not want us there. In fact, my squadron, right before I checked in, had gone to Congress to petition Congress to keep women out. And that's actually illegal for military people to do, but it was tolerated. And that just kind of shows you how just vehemently passionate men were to keep women out of the cockpit at that time.
What kind of harassment did you experience?
Well, the very first day I checked into that squadron, there was a golf tournament, and basically I was thrown a Hooters outfit and told that instead of playing golf like the other male pilots were doing, that I was going to drive the beer cart around in a Hooters outfit.
You didn't do it.
I didn't. You know, it's funny, Frank, though, when I look back at that time, I put my foot down and I basically threw it back at them and said, I am not going to do that. And I wonder how my life would have changed had I just gulped it and then put that outfit on. I think the guys would have accepted me better. I think that was their test of me. And I think from that moment on, I was kind of a marked person as a troublemaker. Mm. And so, you know, I'm not telling women that they should, you know, go along with sexual harassment, but it is one of those little things that, that you look back on and you wonder about, had I gone along with their game, what would have been different?
Well, what was it like? Because it was more than that. I mean, it seems to me that some of the harassment was dangerous.
Yes. And that's actually what drove my final resignation to leave. The guys would take my flight gear that was in a special place and then they would hide it. And, you know, when people are taking safety equipment out of your flight gear and hiding them around the squadron, I mean, that's starting to border on unsafe. And occasionally I would the guys would get on the radio and give me bogus calls. You know, and that was actually the last straw because I was being taxied in and around the fuel pits and these guys, you know, they were being very silly, but this is very dangerous. And the senior administration just looked the other way.
Did you ever have sober conversations with some of these guys? Did they ever tell you why they felt this way?
Yeah, you know, not all the guys were bad. And in fact, I would tell you most of the fighter pilots I flew with on a one-to-one basis were good guys. But it was definitely something with the groupthink mentality mm-hmm. that would drive this behavior. But one-on-one, I had this one conversation with, he was a Vietnam-era fighter pilot. And he was at the bar. And we were in Fallon, Nevada, where we do a lot of bomb dropping. And it was a long day. And at the end of the day, after a couple of drinks, he looked at me and said, you know, it's not that I just don't want to fly with you as a person, but if you're a woman and you can do these missions as good as me, then what does that make me? Yeah. And I just thought that was so poignant. And I think that really kind of captures the essence of when men feel threatened by women. And I even today in 2014, if we're still struggling with that, what it means to throw like a girl or fly like a girl or drop a bomb like a girl, what does that mean?
That is a clip from an interview with drone expert and former fighter pilot Missy Cummings, and I am here today with producer Anita Rao, looking back on some of her favorite shows for the past year. So what stood out for you in that interview?
Yeah, Frank, so you know, in the pre-interview process as a producer, before they come and sit with you live in the studio, a producer will spend some time with them on the phone. And when I was doing my pre-interview with Missy, she was so honest. She told me story after story that really took me into the heart of what her experiences were like. You never know in live radio whether a person is going to show up the same way in studio as they did with you on the phone. And this, to me, she blew me away how honest she was with you in studio and to an audience of thousands of people across the state. It was really poignant to me to hear those memories.
I've often wondered what it's like for you as a producer who has spent all of this time making sure we've got somebody who's got a great story and can tell it and has spent all this time. Hours, as you say, we're only going to have 1 hour. So a lot of it is not going to be ever broadcast. And I wonder what it's like for you on the other side of the glass to hear the thing that actually goes out, knowing what you know about these people.
It's a challenge, definitely, to feel like some of the parts of the story aren't there. But I think that's sort of the beauty of producing for this kind of show is at a certain point you have to release control and really turn it over to the organic live experience that happens in here.
Well, another live experience we had was a quite a different kind of a meet. Tell us about getting ready to meet Art Pope.
Yeah, so this was one of my very first Monday meet segments back when I started. And I think to date it was still the most challenging segment that I've worked on here as a producer. There were so many different topics that we wanted to cover in our interview. And in order to have the kind of conversation that we wanted to have with Art Pope, we really needed to make sure that we had our facts straight. We were confident going in with what we went in with so we could have those higher level conversations. So I spent hours on the phone with people around the country, digging through materials, learning way more about campaign finance law than I ever thought I would. But I think it proved to create a good conversation.
Let's listen.
Well, you mentioned 2010. The Republican-controlled legislature, of course, began the process of redistricting. You were co-counsel of the leadership, but let's talk about the amount of money that was spent. Because in that race, there were three organizations that you were a part of and donated to that represented 72% of the outside spending on legislative races in the state of North Carolina came from three organizations that you either sat on the boards of or donated to. Art, you influenced the top three in that race.
In 2010, you know, to start with the numbers, the Democratic Party spent $15.3 million, according to the North Carolina Board of Election, the Democrat Party and its legislative candidates. That contrasts the Republican Party that only spent $11.6 million. So the Democrats were outspending Republicans. Now, you add in what you're talking about, the independent expenditures, mm-hmm. and there were independent expenditure groups supporting the Democratic Party, as well as conservative groups supporting Republican candidates or who characterize as supporting them. When you add in the independent expenditures, the Democrat Party plus the independent expenditures by progressive organizations, the NCAE, the union affiliates for the teachers, they spent $17.5 million, whereas for the conservatives and Republicans, they spent $13.6 million. So the most money was spent by the Democratic Party and the pro-union progressive organizations combined compared to the Republican Party and the pro-business and conservative groups combined. It was a competitive election.
Real Jobs NC, Civitas Action, Americans for Prosperity, you helped start them all in North Carolina. Counted, those are three groups. 72% of the independent spending in that race, the independent spending, came from organizations that you were on the board of or helped found. So we can talk about the numbers of millions of dollars, but three groups, 72% of the independent spending on a crucial race. And so I will say it is wisely spent because it was on legislative races that would then become redistricting races. So the Democrats may not have spent too smart.
A clip from our interview with former State Budget Director Art Pope. I'm here today with producer Anita Rao, looking back at some of her favorite shows over the past years. Boy, you can't think of two different kinds of meets. I mean, when Missy Cummings tells a story about being thrown a Hooters outfit and to drive a golf cart as with her fellow fighter pilots, that tells you all you need to know about sexual discrimination, even though there are plenty of statistics that could tell another story. With a guy like Art Pope and a story like that, we have to do our due diligence and come up with the numbers. Very different kind of research, huh?
Very different kind of research. And with Art Pope, obviously, I didn't get to do a pre-interview, so I didn't get a chance to hear those backstories, which we did try to get some of to make it sound like a meet. But you're right. That's one of the things about being a producer on this kind of show that's so fun, though, is that one day you're learning about drones and new technology and driverless cars, and the next day you're digging through documents and all kinds of things you never thought you'd be doing.
We'll find out some more of the exciting work that gets done here on The State of Things when we continue our conversation with Anita Rao to hear some of her favorite moments on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're spending an hour with State of Things producer Anita Rao, looking back at the past year and talking about some of the highlights. We talked about some of your favorite segments, Anita, from our Monday Meet series, but now you're going to take us in a different direction. Tell us what you've got.
Yeah, so I want to spend this next part of the show talking about some segments that I think talk about social justice issues that we hear about a lot, but really add a new spin to the conversation. So I'm going to start with the segment that we did. It was an hour-long show from September about sexual assault on college campuses around the country. And sadly, it seems like almost every week we have another story about a campus that's really struggling to figure out the best way to handle concerns and make sure students feel safe and respected on campus. So we really wanted to take a look at how this student-led movement to raise awareness about this has come about, but also take a step back and look at the broader sociological and cultural factors that contribute to this problem.
We started the hour listening to the personal story of Andrea Pino, who is a sexual assault survivor and who has worked to help other students around the country file Title IX complaints. And then we continued the conversation with a number of experts who helped us unpack some of the sociological and cultural issues that contribute to this problem. Joining us now is NC State sociology professor Michael Schwalbe. He is a gender scholar who studies the relationship between masculinity and violence. Welcome back, Michael.
Good to have you. Glad to be back.
What are some of the cultural messages that we see that can reinforce some of this behavior on campus?
Well, in our culture, men are still taught that to be respectable as men, they should be strong, they should be powerful, they should be able to control their environments or things in their environments and get what they're after, even in the face of resistance. And those messages come from all directions, really, from the time boys are little. Those messages come from sports, from other media, films, popular music, video games, military, pornography. So young men in our culture are still getting these messages that to be real men, they should be strong and powerful and heterosexually potent.
There are probably reasons for this. I would imagine that to survive in this economy, one that privileges competition and victory and strength over weakness, and frankly, exploiting weakness, it's actually a virtue in this economy. And so, therefore, the message is culturally appropriate in some ways.
Absolutely. In a capitalist society, we're pitted against each other, really, to make a living. And men are taught to strive for status and power in the workplace. And so being competitive really isn't optional if men want to succeed in this kind of economy. And so, as I say, that's a general message that boys and men get about what it means to be a respectable man. And I think young men, college-age men, don't have a lot of institutional power to feel this way in any other way. And so it manifests a lot of times in their interpersonal relationships and high-risk behavior.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that because it's interesting that the particularity of the peculiarness of the college environment can make things worse for young men.
Well, it can because they're in a kind of status competition with other men. And as I say, they don't have much institutional power or authority. So that's why we see self-destructive behavior, some of the binge drinking, the high-risk behavior. And sometimes this manifests in a kind of sexual conquesting that comes at the expense of young women.
And those who are sort of glorified on campus tend to be those who represent that hypermasculinity. They tend to be male athletes or perhaps, you know, in fraternities and that kind of thing. Well, Juliet, I know that you've led masculinity trainings around the state. What's your approach to getting that conversation going?
Sure. Well, I certainly, in terms of masculinity trainings, that I always do my work in collaboration with folks. And so my approach to doing that work has always come from, and I worked with Dr. Schwabe at NC State when I was there several years ago. And my work in terms of masculinity is having the conversation that is looking at our individual roles and looking at sexual violence as a community problem. Not, you know, you can't, nobody responds well to feeling attacked. And so trying to connect with all men about why this is a problem and that the reality is sexual violence will not end until we have gender equality and really all forms of equality.
Monica, this can be a difficult conversation, though, can it? Because ultimately it would challenge men, white men, to examine their privilege, and nobody wants to acknowledge that, and particularly if they had to give it up once they recognized it.
Well said. I think there are a couple things that were said here that speaks to that. You started out by framing our work as social justice and ending all forms of oppression. And we talked a little bit about that. And that's what's important to me about recognizing is we often talk about being pitted against each other. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about men giving up something. And I think for me, again, it's a change of the narrative of recognizing that men actually gain something when women are treated fairly and equally and our vulnerable populations are seen as valuable and equal citizens. And so, but we also know that the challenge of that is not just economy, but we live in a capitalistic society. And so every piece of perpetuating sexual violence fuels our economy through our advertisement, through everything that we see is actually built into our economy. And so I think it's important to notice changing the narrative is going to be a long process, and I'm glad we're engaged.
That is a clip from an hour-long conversation about sexual assault on college campuses. It aired originally in September. I'm here now with producer Anita Rao, who chose that as among her top picks looking back at the year 2014. What was it that stood out for you in that program and in that segment, I guess, in particular?
Yeah, so I love that we were really able to break apart some big ideas that can seem really intangible sometimes. Patriarchy, masculinity, systems of oppression. We hear these words thrown around a lot, but we don't really know what they mean. And I feel like all of our guests on this program really took those and deconstructed them in a way that helped us understand how these things actually manifest themselves in every interaction we have, both socially, economically, politically.
This, by the way, highlights the art of the producer, which is not always visible to the audience. Thank goodness. We'd like to cover the seams. What you have to listen for on big ideas like this, which have been covered one way or another over and over again, and yet never well enough in some ways, how do we take some of the deeper issues, some of the deeper contextual elements of this story, which can be thick, it can be dense, it can be data-driven, and have it come out in a conversation, meaning you have to really listen for the people who can express themselves verbally and in conversation in a way that brings home some of these very difficult concepts.
Exactly. And that's really what we tried to do with this segment, was sort of take that zoom out approach, starting with a personal narrative and then having people who were really steeped in the data but knew how to talk about its implications and help people understand how their everyday interactions are really shaped by these bigger systems.
Well, next you're going to take us into some personal stories that highlight concerns about child labor in North Carolina. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So earlier this year, the advocacy group Human Rights Watch released a report documenting issues found on tobacco farms around the South. And North Carolina was just one of the states that they looked at. It's important, though, because about half of American-produced tobacco is actually grown here in North Carolina. So what we did in this conversation was we discussed the report and its significance from a variety of perspectives. We spoke with a man from the Tobacco Growers Association of North Carolina. His name is Graham Boyd. And he joined us to give us his perspective on what he thought were some of the problematic points of the report. A public health expert named Sarah Quant also joined the conversation. She's a professor of public health at Wake Forest School of Medicine, and she told us about the decades of research that she's been doing on health issues affecting farm workers around the state and how that relates to health issues affecting children working on farms specifically. And then we also heard from Margaret Worth, and she was one of the children's rights researchers at Human Rights Watch who co-authored the report. So she really helped set up for us what she described as the double standard in U.S. labor law that permits children to work in agriculture from younger ages and for longer hours than any other industry. But we started the conversation hearing the personal stories of two young women who started working in the tobacco fields when they were young. Their names are Neftali and Yesenia Cuello, and they started working in the fields in North Carolina when they were 12 and 14 years old.
Living in rural North Carolina, like, I believe the most fun you could have is probably running outside and playing and being in the sun and, you know, stuff like that. But I want to say whenever we would picture maybe the kind of work the mother would do, we thought it was so easy. You know, just all you got to do is pick these little things off some plants and make it happen. But it's very, very difficult. I believe our first day we did work 12 hours from 6 to 6.
Tell us about that first day, Neftali.
Well, my first day being 12, I was, I guess, more exposed and, you know, younger, vulnerable to everything else. And I got left behind a lot. I was working with a whole lot of older people and, you know, I was trying to keep up with them. And my mother went and helped me a lot of times, you know, trying to get me back up to caught up to where everybody was. But I mean, it was so hot by the time it got to 12 o'clock. And, you know, I was fainting. My mother had to go all the way to the very beginning of a tobacco row to go get me some water. And I mean, you face a lot of risk because, like, if you get fired, you risk your family getting fired just from that. So I had to keep going.
Were you aware of that at the time, kind of your first day, that you were actually putting your mother's job at risk? In that sense?
No, we didn't know a whole lot of the risk that we faced, not only with heat stress or my mother losing her job, knowing that she was the only one help supporting our family, which I believe it was a family of five at the time, but now we're six. Mm-hmm. But we valued all the work that she did. She was very independent, which was one of the main reasons why we also started working, because we strive to be independent ourselves.
So what do you wear? Do you know? Did you know kind of what to do and what to wear when you went out the first day?
Our first day, we really just wanted to wear some tank tops. You know, you think it's going to be hot out there, you know, kind of beach kind of thing. My mother went and told us, you are wearing some baggy pants, some really long sleeves. You're wearing boots. You're wearing gloves. You're wearing a hat. I said, it's not winter. But when we got there, I saw the reason why.
So you're wearing all this stuff, and what are some of the reasons why you have to wear all that?
I believe the knowledge that we did have as far as wearing gloves and hats and long sleeves came from my mother, because she does have experience working in the fields. But we, like, sometimes our gloves would rip and we would want to work without them. Mom would be like, no, you know, grab another pair of gloves. But it wasn't provided for us. Like, we would have to bring our own gloves and provide everything for ourselves.
Neftali, what have you learned about why you need to wear gloves since then?
I learned the fact that, you know, especially in the mornings, you know, tobacco is wet. So you always want to wear gloves because nicotine is absorbed faster, you know, when the leaves are wet and through everything. And there were several times they sprayed us with pesticides, but we never really knew exactly, you know, what they were, if they were harmful or anything.
I mean, did you have any sense at the time that they were that this was probably not a good thing?
No, honestly, whenever we would get sprayed or get the drift from it, we assumed that maybe it was some fertilizer that they were spraying. We didn't find out that what pesticides were and the harms that come from them until 4 years later.
Well, you talked about not knowing all of the hazards when you started. And Neftali, I know you learned about some of those later when you got involved with a group called NC Field, right? Is that right? Tell us about that.
Well, NC Fields is a nonprofit organization that helps support farm workers. It's an acronym that stands for North Carolina Focuses on Increasing Education, Leadership, and Dignity Within the Farm Worker Community. So what we do is mostly try and help close the gap in between like organizations that help support farm workers and actual farm workers, because a large thing that we see is that there's a language barrier there. So we try and help fill that gap.
I mean, you go into fields and talk with people. How do you reach young workers especially and tell them about some of the risks and some of the precautions they should be taking?
Well, we've worked a whole lot with Dr. Thomas Arkery with Wake Forest University School of Medicine. So through the knowledge that they give us, we give to the community because we're so embedded into the community.
Who hired you? Were you working with a contractor or directly with the grower in your case?
It was actually working with a contractor up until just this year when I went with my mom to work in planting tobacco that I actually worked with a farmer.
I'm wondering how much the contractor told you or your mom about, again, the precautions to take, what's being sprayed on the field, when, any of that.
We are supposed to receive a pesticide training, I think, every
4 years.
4 years, and we never received one. When we first started working, the contractor was just like, if you know how to do the job, get started.
That's a clip from a conversation about child labor on tobacco fields in North Carolina. It aired originally in June, and I'm talking with producer Anita Rao about some of her favorites. What did you like about that one?
I mean, this was a very moving and surprising interview for me because I feel like, you know, the content is really data heavy, the Human Rights Watch report with all of these facts and figures. But to hear in their voices the stories of what it's like to be on that farm, be in that field with your mom and see tractors going by and not knowing whether it's pesticide or fertilizer. I mean, I really feel like it puts you in that moment in a way that you can't really get to from just reading a report. So they really humanized that experience and I think drew people into an issue that I really haven't heard talked much about before.
And there again, it's another example. When this a story like this, a conversation like this comes to the table, it comes by way of a press release about the data, about a new report. You read the data. There might be a news report about it and we read it. I will tell you just from where I sit, the difference between what we read and talked about at a meeting and the first sort of press release we read and then actually hearing these voices and people telling their stories in conversation like that is just utterly transformational. Sort of wish all the listeners could have read that press release, then heard the piece to understand how this gets transformed.
Exactly. And that's the one thing we always ask in our meetings. We say, what's the conversation here and who are the voices that we need to be hearing from? And that's how you turn a press release into a conversation that can hopefully move people to action.
Well, your third social justice pick is from a conversation with a guest who's an expert at busting poverty myths. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So I loved this interview. A couple of months ago, we interviewed a woman named Linda Tirado. She's quite an interesting backstory. About a year ago, she found a question in an online forum that said, why do poor people do things that seem so self-destructive? And at the time, she was a young mother. She was working two jobs. She was trying to go back to school. And so she sat down and she wrote a response to how she felt about that question. And that response ended up going viral and led her to writing a whole book. So she came on to talk to us about her book. It was called Hand to Mouth. And here is a clip from a conversation where she's responding to a common argument that poor people are poor because they've made mistakes that leads them to where they are today.
It's almost like we're going to keep needing a service class, whether or not they all go to college. And it's also, I like to say, look, if you put 10 decent jobs in front of 1,000 people looking for work, you cannot blame 990 people for not bootstrapping it a little harder. I mean, you can look at them and say, listen, if you just wanted it more, you totally could have made it. And that's a true thing. If you'd been a little more skilled, a little more prepared, a little more something, but you know you're going to send home a bunch of unemployed people. And if that's the system that we're going to set up, then no, I don't take responsibility for the parts that are not my own. I will take responsibility for my own decisions. Some of them have been short-sighted. Some of them were immature. Some of them are just bad because not all of the time am I perfect. And I will totally cop to that. But you can't tell me that post-2008, my failure to get back into school is somehow entirely my fault. As though when people succeed, it's all on them, right? And when people fail, it's all on them. But you know what? You didn't build that, and neither did I. None of us built this. We do this together. This is a society that we have created, and it does not have the opportunities that we need. And until we've set up a society in which it's really hard to fail, you can't blame people for sometimes failing. If we had it set up to where, like, look, you have socialized education, you have socialized medicine, all you have to do is show up and get through your classes, then you can look at me and say it's a bad decision to drop out of school. But when you're saying don't take on debt that you can't afford, don't get yourself into risky financial situations, and oh, by the way, we're going to need you to take $30,000 of debt out the second you turn 18 to get through a college degree that you're not sure is going to be useful in a field that you're not entirely sure that you like when you're not mature enough to get through classes, sweetie, I made the best decision I could leaving school.
I'm going to leave it at that. I mean, that was certainly well put, and I think the best possible answer I've ever heard to that sort of thoughtless critique. Yeah, I could. If I ever wanted a co-host, it would be Linda Tirado about her book Hand to Mouth, which aired in October. And I'm here with producer Anita Rao talking about why you like that segment. Well, why? Why not?
Why not? Exactly, Frank. And, you know, our show is a talk show, so it's all about conversation. But what I love about this is you're speechless. I mean, nobody could have said it better than she could have. And sometimes it's just such a blessing to get guests like that who they've lived the experience, they've reflected on it, and they can talk about it in a way that's more poignant than anybody else can. And I think she's a perfect example of that.
Is indeed. My guest this hour, State of Things producer Anita Rao, talking and taking a look back at some of her favorite conversations this year. We will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, continuing our series of shows, looking back at the last year, listening to some of our favorite segments. Today's segments have been picked by producer Anita Rao, who is here to tell me about more of her favorites. What's next?
All right, Frank. So now we're going to go meta here and tell you a little bit about an hour-long show we did going behind the scenes of StoryCorps. And so in full disclosure, before I came to work for the State of Things, I was actually up in New York City working for StoryCorps for 3 years in their production department. StoryCorps, by the way, is a nonprofit oral history project that records conversations around the country. Some of them are edited and produced for Morning Edition on NPR every Friday. So one part of their recording process is traveling around the country in mobile Airstream trailers. So these trailers stop in different cities for a couple of weeks at a time and record stories with people who live there. So back in May, the StoryCorps mobile trailer spent a number of weeks in Durham recording just outside of our offices here at American Tobacco. So we thought this would be a good opportunity to hear some great tape from StoryCorps interviews recorded in Durham and around the state of North Carolina, and really go behind the scenes and understand how the operation is run. So we started the hour-long show talking to the founder of StoryCorps, Dave Isay, about his vision for the project.
Let's listen. Tell us how the idea for StoryCorps came about.
Well, I had been making radio documentaries for many years for NPR, and a lot of these documentaries involve people whose voices hadn't kind of normally made it to air. So I was spending a lot of time in prisons and homeless shelters and that sort of stuff. And I came to believe at some point that the act of actually just being interviewed and being listened to could be a very important moment in people's lives, and kind of had this crazy idea almost to turn radio documentary on its head and say that the purpose isn't what we broadcast, but giving people the chance to be heard. It's the interviews themselves. So I wanted to start this kind of almost social public service project where, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, and someday hopefully hundreds of thousands of people have the chance to be listened to in this way. And in doing so, you know, recognize how much their lives matter. You know, I think it's a very, very simple idea. It's two people, as you know, in a booth with the help of a trained facilitator having these conversations.
That's a clip from a conversation with StoryCorps founder Dave Isay, part of an hour-long show going behind the scenes of StoryCorps. Anita Rao produced that segment and that show. She also worked for StoryCorps before she came here. And of course, it gets to one of the challenges. When you take anybody behind the scenes, there's always the chance that you're going to get a little too self-indulgent. So one of the challenge in a show like this is to make sure that it's great on its own merits. It's interesting on its own merits. It tells a story. But also, it's kind of cool to be behind the scenes scenes if you're a public radio listener, hey, how do they do that, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so I sort of wanted to do that. I wanted to tell the story of StoryCorps through some of the voices that we don't hear very often. So we start with Dave Isay, and then in the next segment, we talk to some of the StoryCorps producers, and we heard from them about some of their favorite StoryCorps segments that made it to air that were recorded here in North Carolina. And they were actually two of my bosses. So I got a chance to pre-interview some people that I used to work under, which is always pretty fun. So here you are talking with StoryCorps senior producer Michael Garofalo.
I know StoryCorps recorded an interview a number of years ago in Durham about a dying profession. Michael, tell us about that one.
Yeah, that was an interview between Greg Goines and Steve Nelms, and it was recorded in Durham, right on the tobacco campus there. These two guys were tobacco auctioneers for a long, long time. Of course, they no longer are employed. They came in to talk about the tradition and the people they learned from and to do a little auctioneering on mic.
Let's hear a little clip.
My name is Greg Goines. I'm 61 years old.
I'm Steve Nelms. I'm 57 years old. Greg and I, we were tobacco auctioneers for a long time.
We have been. We're not anything now. That's all over.
American 87, 87, 86, down, middle, la, la, 82.
How you do the starting, Steve?
82.
82, darling.
When I went to auction school, we started off, we just hum numbers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then we hum them backwards.
You know, if a tobacco auctioneer would follow the whole circuit, he didn't spend about 2 months at home. We'd travel from Georgia to North Carolina. And then we'd either go to Tennessee or Kentucky, later on to Virginia. And you look forward to it every year. You know, when July came, we'd get ready to travel. We all wore coats and ties, and everybody dressed up. It was a job to have a lot of pride in. But in the last 10, 12 years, that has really changed.
And I knew we were going to see some change, but I had no idea it would be this this drastic and this quick.
We've lost a lifestyle, Steve.
Yeah, we lost a complete lifestyle. We really did. Mm-hmm. And plus, we lost a job and a livelihood. Tobacco business, it's been good for us. Been good to us. And I have enjoyed it.
Definitely. I mean, hey, this has been my life 35 years. It was.
89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89, 89 Garofalo is one of the senior producers for StoryCorps, and I'm talking with him today. So, Michael, it's kind of interesting to hear that piece because it represents kind of two types of story, right? I mean, a lot of people have lost their jobs and with whole industries that have gone out of business, but this is a very particular industry, too. So I guess you've got the best of both worlds, a very local, very particular story that might have traction nationally, right?
I think that's when StoryCorps is at its best, is when it's a universal story. It's something that anybody anywhere in the country can understand and, you know, it will resonate with you. But it doesn't lose the local character and the local flavor of the place it was recorded. And one thing that I think StoryCorps really tries to do and is really good at, too, is capturing these voices and these traditions and jobs that are disappearing and that won't be around for much longer. And that's a real value of the project.
I wonder how you balance this. I mean, if you're, you know, people come from out of town, the facilitators, you as producers, you're not all from each region of the country. How do you develop an ear for an accent, a way of speaking that treats those speakers lovingly and not quite kind of as colorful artifacts, you know, as caricatures? I mean, it seems to me that that's one of the occupational hazards that you've managed to avoid at StoryCorps.
Oh, well, I consider that a compliment. Thank you very much. I think it's just about respecting what the person has to say. You know, we don't dictate what people say in the booth. And we just try to be as true in the editing process, because all these pieces do come out of a longer interview. We try to be as true as possible to their natural cadence, the way that someone speaks and the rhythm of their speech as possible. We try not to manipulate that in a way that could sound reductive in some way.
Right. That's a clip from a conversation with StoryCorps producer Michael Garofalo, and it's part of an hour-long show. Taking us behind the scenes of StoryCorps, Anita Rao is our producer. She produced that segment. We're talking about it. And, you know, it's interesting. The producers then walked us through some of the types of StoryCorps stories that work well for broadcast. But, of course, you already knew that. And I wonder what it's like for you as a producer. You know, so often you're as surprised as I am with the subject. You have to study it. We talk about it together. It's new for you. It's new for me. But this wasn't new for you. And so that seems to me a different kind of story to put on the air.
Yeah, it definitely was. I think in some ways it made it easier because right from the beginning of my production process, I knew what the most interesting and surprising elements were of the project that I wanted to focus on. And it was really important to me that I include a lot of archival tape from StoryCorps in this hour of the show, because I wanted to make sure that listeners really had the opportunity to feel that sound, the special StoryCorps interview sound, so they really understood the reflections that the producers and Dave and the facilitators were making about that space and that type of conversation. But I think in general, it was also an interesting opportunity for me to hear what Katie and Michael, the two senior producers, had to say while reflecting on their creative process. Because while at StoryCorps, we did have a lot of time, or a lot more time than many other production operations, to sit together and reflect, because we produced one story a week. It was nice for me to hear them reflect on that with you, sort of outside of the context of the StoryCorps conference room. And I think in the kind of production work that happened at StoryCorps, as staff members, we really had an opportunity to enter into people's worlds in a very intimate way, into their homes, to record interviews with them, into their very personal relationships. And we sat in the room with them, hearing them talk to one another. So it was really fun for me to hear how other people that had been in and around that space sort of brought forward those memories with them throughout the rest of their career, and how some stick with you and some don't. And I think hearing that really enhances your own ability to continue to approach this kind of work in a really honest and thoughtful way.
We're getting close to the end now. I know you have at least one last clip for us, right?
That's right. So this last clip is from the last part of the show that was going behind the scenes of StoryCorps. And it's actually my favorite part of that show, because it's hearing the voices of the people who are really at the heart of the StoryCorps operation. They're called facilitators, and their job is to sit in the recording booth with people and help them have conversations, encourage them to sort of say names or dates of things that will help this be a conversation that can be archived and make sense to people hundreds of years in the future, but also think about the production value of these conversations and maybe push people a little bit to ask the question they might feel a little hesitant to ask, or facilitate some really intimate moments. And so I think these people have a really special job, and you have to be a really special kind of person to be able to spend hour after hour after hour with people in some of the more intimate conversations of their lives. So here are two facilitators talking to you about their time recording conversations here in Durham.
I mean, obviously people come to you, they're ready to talk. They've chosen to be there and they've paired up. Is it difficult once they sit down in front of a microphone? And what's your role as a facilitator to help people open up? Is it a hard job?
You know, people come with all different levels of nervousness. Some people were sort of drugged there by a relative who said, you know, you have to come with me. Grandma, I really want you to do this interview. Other people have been looking forward to it and planned. And we sort of try to find a way to meet them in the middle, where they can sit down and have a conversation that's not scripted, but also is comfortable. So we try to make them feel comfortable from the beginning. But there's something about the space that when people sit down at that table, something changes. We call it a sacred space, and we do that because people sort of show up. They become very present, and lots of things get said, and people are surprised. And
that must be a wonderful thing too, Adriana, when you're watching this kind of moment of surprise and revelation between two people who presumably know each other. That's why they're there, right? And it's interesting, you also recorded a conversation between a mother and a son. They knew each other, they thought. Tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear.
Yeah, we're going to hear from Wafiq Sarif and Adila Shabazz. Wafiq interviewed his mother. He was very curious about her life before he was born. Now, Wafiq is 34, so, you know, this sort of places you. And he wanted to know about her time in the city as a young woman and before she converted to Islam. So it was a wonderful conversation.
I would say right off the bat, what I am most interested in about you is who you were and where you came from before I came along. I'm kind of curious as to how a Southern girl like you found Islam.
I found my way to Islam because I was not really happy in New York. I was dating, I was having fun, but I was still lonely. You can be in New York and be very lonely. And I felt like I needed some spiritual guidance in my life. So I started going to different churches, trying to find a place that I would feel comfortable with. And I mean, I'm not just churches. I went to transcendental meditation. I went to Buddhist place, you know, just trying to find a place that I could feel comfortable. And I remember going to a big, huge church in New York in Harlem. And I felt so out of place. because it was like the people were sort of highfalutinous, the big hats, and no one came over to me, no one said hello. And I just said, I don't think this place is for me. So I decided I would go to Africa. It was kind of in the Back to Africa movement going on. And I didn't say to myself, I'm going to find myself. But I said, I'm going to go on this venture. And I took off. So I went over there. I went to Nigeria. And it was an awesome experience. And every image that I had of Africa, it all crumbled. And it just opened up my eyes that there's something else out of my narrow scope of things. So I was ready for something new.
That's Adila and Wafik, recorded by StoryCorps. Facilitators Chayla Herridge-Meyer and Adriana Gallardo are here to talk about what it's like to facilitate conversations like that, Adriana. I mean, it seems a little bit like Wafik was, you know, thought this was truth or dare. I mean, this is his chance to find out things about his mom that he hadn't known before, right?
One of the most common questions in the booth that never gets old is there something you've never told me that you want to tell me here today? And we always talk about the bravery it takes on both parties to ask that and then to tell somebody that you know very well, like your mother, something you've never told her before. And often in between these questions, we also hear probably the second most common thing is, I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. You've never told me that before. And it might be a small detail from a story, but nevertheless, it's always a surprise to these people what they're revealing to each other.
A clip from a conversation with StoryCorps facilitators, part of an hour-long show going behind the scenes of StoryCorps with former StoryCorps producer Anita Rao, now State of Things producer, looking back on the year 2014, one of your favorites. I wonder what it's like for you, that StoryCorps, you worked there for a while, you produced some of those exquisite 2.5-minute pieces that have all driven us to one emotion or another, and now you're working on the show where we talk for an hour, there are looping conversations that come back and forth and have pauses, and it's kind of a two-pronged question. One, do you think that that job prepared you in any way for this, or did it ruin you for this job in the sense that, is it a big transition? Is it difficult to come to big, long, loping conversations that are live compared to these exquisite pieces that get put on the air?
It is a big transition, and I do think at times I do miss that sort of the art of producing a story, of really creating something at a computer, sitting for hours and listening to how people talk. But I think one of the things that I really learned how to do well at StoryCorps that served me here is ask good questions. Try to get a sense of what makes someone break open. What is it that you can say, or what is the story that you can elicit that lets them show you a part of themselves that they maybe haven't showed you before? And that happens in StoryCorps between people that know each other. But I think it happens on our show all the time in the studio when it's someone that you've never met before. But because we found that information and we know that, we can elicit that again here.
I'm guessing, too, you've developed an ear for that moment, for the story, and for that piece of the story, that moment in the story that's going to transform us. Again, the difference between the press release and what's going to translate on the air, having an ear for that is certainly vital for us here on the show.
Exactly. And I think it's sort of a working backwards. It's you hear that and you know, aha, this person, they can talk, they can tell a story, they can really share something new. And then you find all of the supporting elements that will make them last for a whole hour on the radio. But you can really get a sense quickly on the phone with someone whether or not they have the charisma and the type of personality that will work well.
Great stuff. Thank you for a great year, Anita.
Thanks, Frank.
Anita Rao, one of the producers here on The State of Things, sharing some of her favorites for the past year. You can find them all at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern, Robin Copley, the technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.